Chapter 13. Asa Heather. As the moon rose, the witches began their spell to heal Will's wound. They woke him and asked him to lay the knife on the ground where it caught a glitter of starlight. Lyra sat nearby, stirring some herbs in a pot of boiling water over a fire, and while her companions clapped and stamped and cried in rhythm, Seraphina crouched over the knife and sang in a high, fierce tone,
"Little knife, they tore your iron out of Mother Earth's entrails, built a fire and boiled the ore, made it weep and bleed and flood, hammered it and tempered it, plunging it in icy water, heating it inside the forge, till your blade was blood-red, scorching. Then they made you wound the water once again and yet again, till the steam was boiling fog, and the water cried for mercy. And when you sliced a single shade into 30,000 shadows, then they knew that you were ready. Then they called you Subtle One. But Little Knife, what have you done? Unlocked blood gates left them wide. Little Knife, your mother calls you from the entrails of the earth, from her deepest mines and caverns, from her secret iron womb. Listen!"
And Seraphina stamped again and clapped her hands with the other witches, and they shook their throats to make a wild ululation that tore at the air like claws. Will, seated in the middle of them, felt a chill at the core of his spine. Then Seraphina Pekala turned to Will himself and took his wounded hand in both of hers. When she sang this time, he nearly flinched, so fierce was her high, clear voice, so glittering her eyes. But he sat without moving and let the spell go on.
"Blood, obey me. Turn around. Be a lake and not a river. When you reach the open air, stop and build a clotted wall. Build it firm to hold the flood back. Blood, your sky is the skull dome. Your sun is the open eye. Your wind, the breath inside the lungs. Blood, your world is bounded. Stay there."
Will thought he could feel all the atoms of his body responding to her command, and he joined in, urging his leaking blood to listen and obey. She put his hand down and turned to the little iron pot over the fire. A bitter steam was rising from it, and Will heard the liquid bubbling fiercely. Seraphina sang,
"Oak bark, spider silk, ground moss, saltweed, grip close, bind tight. Hold fast, close up, bar the door, lock the gate, stiffen the blood wall, dry the gore flood."
Then the witch took her own knife and split an alder sapling along its whole length. The wounded whiteness gleamed open in the moon. She daubed some of the steaming liquid into the split, then closed up the wood, easing it together from the root to the tip. And the sapling was whole again. Will heard Lyra gasp and turned to see another witch holding a squirming, struggling hare in her tough hands. The animal was panting, wild-eyed, kicking furiously, but the witch's hands were merciless. In one she held its forelegs, and with the other she grasped its hind legs and pulled the frenzied hare out straight, its heaving belly upward. Seraphina's knife swept across it. Will felt himself grow dizzy, and Lyra was restraining Pantalaimon. Hare formed himself in sympathy, who was bucking and snapping in her arms. The real hare fell still, eyes bulging, breast heaving, entrails glistening. But Seraphina took some more of the decoction and trickled it into the gaping wound, and then closed up the wound with her fingers, smoothing the wet fur over it until there was no wound at all. The witch holding the animal relaxed her grip and let it gently to the ground, where it shook itself, turned to lick its flank, flicked its ears, and nibbled a blade of grass as if it were completely alone. Suddenly it seemed to become aware of the circle of witches around it, and like an arrow it shot away, whole again, bounding swiftly off into the dark. Lyra, soothing Pantalaimon, glanced at Will and saw that he knew what it meant. The medicine was ready. He held out his hand, and as Seraphina daubed the steaming mixture on the bleeding stumps of his fingers, he looked away and breathed in sharply several times, but he didn't flinch. Once his open flesh was thoroughly soaked, the witch pressed some of the sodden herbs onto the wounds and tied them tight around with a strip of silk. And that was it. The spell was done. Will slept deeply through the rest of the night. It was cold, but the witches piled leaves over him, and Lyra slept huddled close behind his back. In the morning, Seraphina dressed his wound again, and he tried to see from her expression whether it was healing, but her face was calm and impassive. Once they'd eaten, Seraphina told the children that the witches had agreed that since they'd come into this world to find Lyra and be her guardians, they'd help Lyra do what she now knew her task to be, namely to guide Will to his father. So they all set off, and it was quiet going for the most part. Lyra consulted the alethiometer to begin with, but warily, and learned that they should travel in the direction of the distant mountains they could see across the great bay. Never having been this high above the city, they weren't aware of how the coastline curved, and the mountains had been below the horizon. But now when the trees thinned, or when a slope fell away below them, they could look out to the empty blue sea and to the high blue mountains beyond, which were their destination. It seemed a long way to go. They spoke little. Lyra was busy looking at all the life in the forest, from woodpeckers to squirrels to little green moss snakes with diamonds down their backs, and Will needed all his energy simply to keep going. Lyra and Pantalaimon discussed him endlessly.
"We could look at the alethiometer,"
Pantalaimon said at one point when they dawdled on the path to see how close they could get to a browsing fawn before it saw them.
"We never promised not to, and we could find out all kinds of things for him. We'd be doing it for him, not for us."
"Don't be stupid. It would be us we'd be doing it for, because he'd never ask. You're just greedy and nosy, Pan."
"That makes a change. It's normally you who's greedy and nosy, and me who has to warn you not to do things. Like in the retiring room at Jordan. I never wanted to go in there."
"If we hadn't, Pan, do you think all this would have happened?"
"No, because the Master would have poisoned Lord Asriel, and that would have been the end of it."
"Yeah, I suppose. Who do you think Will's father is, though? And why is he important?"
"That's what I mean. We could find out in a moment."
And she looked wistful.
"I might have done once, but I'm changing, I think, Pan."
"No, you're not."
"You might not be. Hey, Pan, when I change, you'll stop changing. What are you going to be?"
"A flea, I hope."
"No, but don't you get any feelings about what you might be?"
"No, I don't want to either."
"You're sulking because I won't do what you want."
He changed into a pig and grunted and squealed and snorted till she laughed at him. And then he changed into a squirrel and darted through the branches beside her.
"Who do you think his father is? Do you think he could be anyone we met?"
"Could be, but he's bound to be someone important. Almost as important as Lord Asriel. Bound to be. We know what we're doing is important after all."
"We don't know it. We think it is, but we don't know. We just decided to look for dust because Roger died."
"We know it's important,"
Lyra said hotly, and she even stamped her foot.
"And so do the witches. They come all this way to look for us as to be my guardians and help me. And we've got to help Will find his father. That's important. You know it is too, else you wouldn't have licked him when he was wounded. Why'd you do that anyway? You never asked me if you could. I couldn't believe it when you did that."
"I did it because he didn't have a demon and he needed one. And if you were half as good at seeing things as you think you are, you'd have known that."
"I did know it, really."
They stopped then because they'd caught up with Will, who was sitting on a rock beside the path. Pantalaimon became a flycatcher, and as he flew among the branches, Lyra said,
"Will, what do you think those kids will do now?"
"They won't be following us. They were too frightened of the witches. Maybe they'll just go back to drifting about."
"Yeah, probably. They might want to use the knife, though. They might come after us for that."
"Let them. They're not having it, not now. I didn't want it at first, but if it can kill the spectres..."
"I never trusted Angelica, not from the beginning."
"Yes, you did."
"Yeah, I did, really. I hated it in the end, that city."
"I thought it was heaven when I first found it. I couldn't imagine anything better than that. And all the time it was full of spectres and we never knew."
"Well, I won't trust kids again. I thought back at Bolvanger that whatever grown-ups did, however bad it was, kids were different. They wouldn't do cruel things like that. But I ain't sure now. I never seen kids like that before, and that's a fact."
"I have."
"When? In your world?"
"Yeah,"
he said awkwardly. Lyra waited and sat still, and presently he went on.
"It was when my mother was having one of her bad times. She and me, we lived on our own, see, because obviously my father wasn't there. And every so often she'd start thinking things that weren't true. And having to do things that didn't make sense. Not to me, anyway. I mean, she had to do them or else she'd get upset and afraid. And so I used to help her. Like, touching all the railings in the park, or counting the leaves on the bush, that kind of thing. She used to get better after a while, but I was afraid of anyone finding out she was like that, because I thought they'd take her away. So I used to look after her and hide it. I never told anyone. And once, she got afraid when I wasn't there to help her. I was at school, and she went out, and she wasn't wearing very much, only she didn't know. And some boys from my school, they found her, and they started...
Will's face was hot. Without being able to help it, he found himself walking up and down and looking away from Lyra because his voice was unsteady and his eyes were watering. He went on.
They were tormenting her, just like those kids at the tower with the cat. They thought she was mad, and they wanted to hurt her, maybe kill her. I wouldn't be surprised. She was just different, and they hated her. Anyway, I found her, and I got her home. And the next day in school, I fought the boy who was leading them. I fought him, and I broke his arm, and I think I broke some of his teeth. I don't know. And I was going to fight the rest of them too, but I got in trouble, and I realised I'd better stop because they'd find out. I mean, the teachers and the authorities, they'd go to my mother and complain about me. And then they'd find out about how she was and take her away. So I just pretended to be sorry and told the teachers I wouldn't do it again. And they punished me for fighting, and I still said nothing. But I kept her safe, see? No one knew apart from those boys, and they knew what I'd do if they said anything. They knew I'd kill them another time. Not just hurt them. And a bit later she got better again. No one knew, ever. But after that, I never trusted children any more than grown-ups. They're just as keen to do bad things. So I wasn't surprised when those kids in Chigatse did that. But I was glad when the witches came.
He sat down again with his back to Lyra, and still not looking at her, he wiped his hand across his eyes. She pretended not to see.
Will, what you said about your mother and Tullio when the spectres got him, and when you said yesterday that you thought the spectres came from your world...
Yes, because it doesn't make sense what was happening to her. She wasn't mad. Those kids might think she was mad and laugh at her and try to hurt her, but they were wrong. She wasn't mad. Except that she was afraid of things that I couldn't see. And she had to do things that looked crazy. You couldn't see the point of them, but obviously she could. Like her counting all the leaves. Or Tullio yesterday, touching the stones in the wall. Maybe that was a way of trying to put the spectres off. If they turned their back on something frightening behind them and tried to get really interested in the stones and how they fit together or the leaves on the bush, like if only they could make themselves find that really important, they'd be safe. I don't know. It looks like that. There were real things for her to be frightened of. Like those men who came and robbed us, but there was something else as well as them. So maybe we do have the spectres in my world. Only we can't see them. And we haven't got a name for them, but they're there. And they keep trying to attack my mother. So that's why I was glad yesterday when the alethiometer said she was all right.
He was breathing fast and his right hand was gripping the handle of the knife in its sheath. Lyra said nothing and Pantalaimon kept very still.
When did you know you had to look for your father?
She said after a while.
A long time ago. I used to pretend he was a prisoner and I'd help him escape. I had long games by myself doing that. He used to go on for days. Or else, he was on this desert island and I'd sail there and bring him home. And he'd know exactly what to do about everything. About my mother especially. And she'd get better and he'd look after her and me. And I could just go to school and have friends. And I'd have a mother and a father too. So I always said to myself that when I grew up, I'd go and look for my father. And my mother used to tell me that I was going to take up my father's mantle. She used to say that to make me feel good. I didn't know what it meant, but it sounded important.
Didn't you have friends?
How could I have friends? Friends. They come to your house and they know your parents and... Sometimes a boy might ask me round to his house, and I might go or I might not. But I could never ask him back, so I never had friends, really. I would have liked... I had my cat. I hope she's all right now. I hope someone's looking after her.
What about the man you killed?
Lyra said, her heart beating hard.
Who was he?
I don't know. If I killed him, I don't care. He deserved it. There were two of them. They kept coming to the house and pestering my mother till she was afraid again, and worse than ever. They wanted to know all about my father, and they wouldn't leave her alone. I'm not sure if they were police or what. I thought at first they were part of a gang or something, and they thought my father had robbed a bank maybe and hidden the money. But they didn't want money. They wanted papers. They wanted some letters that my father had sent. They broke into the house one day, and then I saw it would be safer if my mother was somewhere else. See, I couldn't go to the police and ask them for help, because they'd take my mother away. I didn't know what to do. So in the end, I asked this old lady who used to teach me the piano. She was the only person I could think of. I asked her if my mother could stay with her, and I took her there. I think she'll look after her all right. Anyway, I went back to the house to look for these letters, because I knew where she kept them, and I got them. And the men came to look and broke into the house again. It was night time or early morning, and I was hiding at the top of the stairs, and Moxie, my cat Moxie, she came out of the bedroom, and I didn't see her, nor did the man. And when I knocked into him, she tripped him up, and he fell right to the bottom of the stairs, and I ran away. That's all that happened, so I didn't mean to kill him, but I don't care if I did. I ran away and went to Oxford, and then I found that window. And that only happened because I saw the other cat and stopped to watch her. And she found the window first. If I hadn't seen her, or if Moxie hadn't come out of the bedroom, then...
Yeah, that was lucky. And me and Pam were thinking just now, what if I'd never gone into the wardrobe in the retiring room at Jordan and seen the master put poison in the wine? None of this would have happened either.
Both of them sat silent on the moss-covered rock in the slant of sunlight through the old pines and thought how many tiny chances had conspired to bring them to this place. Each of those chances might have gone a different way. Perhaps in another world, another Will had not seen the window in Sunderland Avenue and had wandered on, tired and lost, towards the Midlands until he was caught. And in another world, another Pantalaimon had persuaded another Lyra not to stay in the retiring room, and another Lord Asriel had been poisoned, and another Roger had survived to play with that Lyra forever on the roofs and in the alleys of another unchanging Oxford. Presently Will was strong enough to go on, and they moved together along the path with the great forest quiet around them. They travelled on through the day, resting, moving, resting again, as the trees grew thinner and the land more rocky. Lyra checked the alethiometer. "Keep going," it said. "This is the right direction." At noon they came to a village untroubled by spectres. Goats pastured on the hillside, a grove of lemon trees cast shade on the stony ground, and children playing in the stream called out and ran for their mothers at the sight of the girl in the tattered clothing and the white-faced, fierce-eyed boy in the blood-stained shirt and the elegant greyhound that walked beside them. The grown-ups were wary but willing to sell some bread and cheese and fruit for one of Lyra's gold coins. The witches kept out of the way, though both children knew they'd be there in a second if any danger threatened. After another round of Lyra's bargaining, one old woman sold them two flasks of goatskin and a fine linen shirt, and Will renounced his filthy T-shirt with relief, washing himself in the icy stream and lying to dry in the hot sun afterwards. Refreshed, they moved on. The land was harsher now. For shade they had to rest in the shadow of rocks, not under wide-spreading trees, and the ground underfoot was hot through the soles of their shoes. The sun pounded at their eyes. They moved more and more slowly as they climbed, and when the sun touched the mountain rims and they saw a little valley open below them, they decided to go no farther. They scrambled down the slope, nearly losing their footing more than once, and then had to shove their way through thickets of dwarf rhododendrons whose dark glossy leaves and crimson flower clusters were heavy with the hum of bees. They came out in the evening shade on a wild meadow bordering a stream. The grass was knee-high and thick with cornflowers, gentians, cinquefoil. Will drank deeply in the stream and then lay down. He couldn't stay awake and he couldn't sleep either. His head was spinning, a daze of strangeness hung over everything, and his hand was sore and throbbing. And what was worse, it had begun to bleed again. When Serafina looked at it, she put more herbs on the wound and tied the silk tighter than ever, but this time her face was troubled. He didn't want to question her, for what would be the point? It was plain to him that the spell hadn't worked, and he could see she knew it too. As darkness fell, he heard Lyra come to lie down close by, and presently he heard a soft purring. Her demon, cat-formed, was dozing with folded paws only a foot or two away from him, and Will whispered,
"Pantalaimon."
The demon's eyes opened. Lyra didn't stir. Pantalaimon whispered,
"Yes, Pan. Am I going to die?"
"The witches won't let you die. Nor will Lyra."
"The spell didn't work. I keep losing blood. I can't have much left to lose. And it's bleeding again and it won't stop. I'm frightened."
"Lyra doesn't think you are."
"Doesn't she?"
"She thinks you're the bravest fighter she ever saw. As brave as Yorick Bernison."
"I suppose I'd better try not to seem frightened then."
He was quiet for a minute or so, and then he said,
"I think Lyra's braver than me. I think she's the best friend I ever had."
"She thinks that about you as well."
Presently Will closed his eyes. Lyra lay unmoving, but her eyes were wide open in the dark, and her heart was beating hard. When Will next became aware of things, it was completely dark, and his hand was hurting more than ever. He sat up carefully and saw a fire burning not far away, where Lyra was trying to toast some bread on a forked stick. There were a couple of birds roasting on a spit as well, and as Will came to sit nearby, Serafina Pekala flew down.
"Will, eat these leaves before you have any other food."
She gave him a handful of soft, bitter-tasting leaves, somewhat like sage, and he chewed them silently and forced them down. They were astringent, but he felt more awake and less cold, and the better for it. They ate the roasted birds, seasoning them with lemon juice, and then another witch brought some blueberries she'd found below the scree, and then the witches gathered around the fire. They talked quietly. Some of them had flown high up to spy, and one had seen a balloon over the sea. Lyra sat up at once.
"Mr. Scoresby's balloon?
There were two men in it, but it was too far away to see who they were. A storm was gathering behind them."
Lyra clapped her hands.
"If Mr. Scoresby's coming, we'll be able to fly, Will. Oh, I hope it's him. I never said goodbye to him, and he was so kind. I wish I could see him again, I really do."
The witch Jutta Kamainen was listening with her red-breasted robin demon bright-eyed on her shoulder, because the mention of Lee Scoresby had reminded her of the quest he'd set out on. She was the witch who had loved Stanislaus Grumman and whose love he'd turned down, the witch Serafina Pekala had brought into this world to prevent her from killing him in their own. Serafina might have noticed, but something else happened. She held up her hand and lifted her head, as did all the other witches. Will and Lyra could hear, very faintly to the north, the cry of some night bird. But it wasn't a bird. The witches knew it at once for a demon. Serafina Pekala stood up, gazing intently into the sky.
"I think it's Rutaskadi."
They kept still, tilting their heads to the wide silence, straining to hear. And then came another cry, closer already, and then a third. And at that, all the witches seized their branches and leapt into the air. All but two, that is, who stood close by, arrows at their bowstrings, guarding Will and Lyra. Somewhere in the dark above, a fight was taking place. And only seconds later, it seemed, they could hear the rush of flight, the whiz of arrows, and the grunt and scream of voices raised in pain or anger or command. And then, with a thud so sudden they had no time to jump, a creature fell from the sky at their feet, a beast of leathery skin and matted fur that Lyra recognized as a cliff ghast, or something similar. It was broken by the fall, and an arrow protruded from its side, but still it lurched up and lunged with a flopping malice at Lyra. The witches couldn't shoot because she was in their line of fire, but Will was there first, and with a knife he slashed backhand, and the creature's head came off and rolled over once or twice. The air left its lungs with a gurgling sigh, and it fell dead. They turned their eyes upwards again, for the fight was coming lower, and the firelight glaring up showed a swift-rushing swirl of black silk, pale limbs, green pine needles, grey-brown, scabby leather. How the witches could keep their balance in the sudden turns and halts and forward darts, let alone aim and shoot, was beyond Will's understanding. Another cliff ghast, and then a third, fell in the stream or on the rocks nearby, stark dead. And then the rest fled, skirling and chittering into the dark towards the north. A few moments later, Serafina Pekala landed with her own witches, and with another, a beautiful witch, fierce-eyed and black-haired, whose cheeks were flushed with anger and excitement. The new witch saw the headless cliff ghast and spat.
"Not from our world. nor from this. Filthy abominations. There are thousands of them breeding like flies. Who is this? Is this the child Lyra? And who is the boy?
Lyra returned her gaze stolidly, though she felt a quickening of her heart, for Ruta Skadi lived so brilliantly in her nerves that she set up a responding thrill in the nerves of anyone close by. Then the witch turned to Will, and he felt the same tingle of intensity, but like Lyra, he controlled his expression. He still had the knife in his hand, and she saw what he'd done with it and smiled. He thrust it into the earth to clean it of the foul thing's blood, and then rinsed it in the stream. Ruta Skadi was saying,
Serafina Pekala, I am learning so much. All the old things are changing, or dying, or empty. I'm hungry.
She ate like an animal, tearing at the remains of the roasted birds and cramming handfuls of bread into her mouth, washing it down with deep gulps from the stream. While she ate, some of the witches carried the dead cliff ghast away, rebuilt the fire, and then set up a watch. The rest came to sit near Ruta Skadi and to hear what she could tell them. She told what had happened when she flew up to meet the angels, and then of her journey to Lord Asriel's fortress.
Sisters, it is the greatest castle you can imagine. Ramparts of basalt, rearing to the skies, with wide roads coming from every direction, and on them cargoes of gunpowder, of food, of armor plate. How has he done this? I think he must have been preparing this for a long time, for eons. He was preparing this before we were born, sisters, even though he is so much younger. But how can that be? I don't know. I can't understand. I think he commands time. He makes it run fast or slow, according to his will. And coming to this fortress are warriors of every kind from every world. Men and women, yes, and fighting spirits too, and armed creatures such as I had never seen. Lizards and apes, great birds with poison spurs, creatures too outlandish to have a name I could guess at. And other worlds have witches, sisters. Did you know that? I spoke to witches from a world like ours, but profoundly different. For those witches live no longer than our short lives. And there are men among them too, men witches, who fly as we do.
Her tale was causing the witches of Serafina Pekala's clan to listen with awe and fear and disbelief. But Serafina believed her and urged her on.
Did you see Lord Asriel, Ruta Skadi? Did you find your way to him?
Yes, I did. And it was not easy, because he lives at the center of so many circles of activity, and he directs them all. But I made myself invisible and found my way to his inmost chamber when he was preparing to sleep.
Every witch there knew what had happened next, and neither Will nor Lyra dreamed of it. So Ruta Skadi had no need to tell, and she went on.
And then I asked him why he was bringing all these forces together, and if it was true what we'd heard about his challenge to the authority, and he laughed. "Do they speak of it in Siberia, then?" he said. And I told him yes, and on Svalbard, and in every region of the North, our North. And I told him of our pact, and how I'd left our world to seek him and find out. And he invited us to join him, sisters, to join his army against the authority. I wished with all my heart I could pledge us there and then. He showed me that to rebel was right and just, when you considered what the agents of the authority did in his name. And I thought of the Bolvanger children, and the other terrible mutilations I have seen in our own Southlands. And he told me of many more hideous cruelties dealt out in the authority's name, of how they capture witches in some worlds and burn them alive, sisters. Yes, witches like ourselves. He opened my eyes. He showed me things I had never seen, cruelties and horrors, all committed in the name of the authority, all designed to destroy the joys and the truthfulness of life. Oh, sisters, I longed to throw myself and my whole clan into the cause, but I knew I must consult you first, and then fly back to our world and talk to Yeva Kasku and Reina Miti and the other witch queens. So I left his chamber invisibly and found my cloud pine and flew away. But before I'd flown far, a great wind came up and hurled me high into the mountains, and I had to take refuge on a cliff top. Knowing the sort of creatures who live on cliffs, I made myself invisible again, and in the darkness I heard voices. It seemed that I'd stumbled on the nesting place of the oldest of all cliff ghasts. He was blind, and they were bringing him food, some stinking carrion from far below, and they were asking him for guidance. "Grandfather," they said, "how far back does your memory go?"
"Way, way back, back long before humans," he said, and his voice was soft and cracked and frail.
"Is it true that the greatest battle ever known is coming soon, Grandfather?"
"Yes, children," he said, "a greater battle than the last one even. Fine feasting for all of us. These will be days of pleasure and plenty for every ghast in every world."
"And who's going to win, Grandfather? Is Lord Asriel going to defeat the Authority?"
"Lord Asriel's army numbers millions," the old cliff ghast told them, "assembled from every world. It's a greater army than the one that fought the Authority before, and it's better led. As for the forces of the Authority, why, they number 100 times as many. But the Authority is age-old, far older even than me, children, and his troops are frightened and complacent where they're not frightened. It would be a close fight. But Lord Asriel would win because he is passionate and daring and he believes his cause is just. Except for one thing, children. He hasn't got Esahetr. Without Esahetr, he and all his forces will go down to defeat. And then we shall feast for years, my children." And he laughed and gnawed the stinking old bone they'd brought to him, and the others all shrieked with glee. Now you can imagine how I listened hard to hear more about this Esahetr, but all I could hear over the howling of the wind was a young ghast asking, "If Lord Asriel needs Esahetr, why doesn't he call him?" And the old ghast said, "Lord Asriel knows no more about Esahetr than you do, child. That is the joke. Laugh long and loud."
But as I tried to get closer to the foul things to learn more, my power failed, sisters. I couldn't hold myself invisible any longer. The younger ones saw me and shrieked out, and I had to flee back into this world through the invisible gateway in the air. A flock of them came after me, and those are the last of them dead over there. But it's clear that Lord Asriel needs us, sisters. Whoever this Esahetr is, Lord Asriel needs us. I wish I could go back to Lord Asriel now and say, "Don't be anxious, we're coming, we, the witches of the north, and we shall help you win." Let's agree now, Serafina Pekala, and call a great council of all the witches, every single clan, and make war.
Serafina Pekala looked at Will, and it seemed to him that she was asking his permission for something. But he could give no guidance, and she looked back at Rutaskadi.
"Not us. Our task now is to help Lyra, and her task is to guide Will to his father. You should fly back, agreed, but we must stay with Lyra."
Rutaskadi tossed her head impatiently.
"Well, if you must."
Will lay down because his wound was hurting him, much more now than when it was fresh. His whole hand was swollen. Lyra, too, lay down with Pantalaimon curled at her neck and watched the fire through half-closed lids and listened sleepily to the murmur of the witches. Rutaskadi walked a little way upstream, and Serafina Pekala went with her.
"Ah, Serafina Pekala, you should see Lord Asriel. He is the greatest commander there ever was. Every detail of his forces is clear in his mind. Imagine the daring of it, to make war on the Creator. But who do you think this Esahetr can be? How have we not heard of him? And how can we urge him to join Lord Asriel?"
"Maybe it's not a him, sister. We know as little as the young cliff ghast. Maybe the old grandfather was laughing at his ignorance. The word sounds as if it means God-destroyer. Did you know that?
Then it might mean us after all, Serafina Pekala. And if it does, then how much stronger his forces will be when we join them. Oh, I long for my arrows to kill those fiends from Bolvanger, and every Bolvanger in every world. Sister, why do they do it? In every world, the agents of the authority are sacrificing children to their cruel god. Why? Why?
They are afraid of dust, though what that is, I don't know.
And this boy you found, who is he? What world does he come from?
Serafina Pekala told her all she knew about Will.
I don't know why he's important,
she finished.
But we serve Lyra. And her instrument tells her that that is her task. And sister, we tried to heal his wound, but we failed. We tried the holding spell, but it didn't work. Maybe the herbs in this world are less potent than ours. It's too hot here for blood moss to grow.
He's strange. He is the same kind as Lord Asriel. Have you looked into his eyes?
To tell the truth, I haven't dared.
The two queens sat quietly by the stream. Time went past. Stars set and other stars rose. A little cry came from the sleepers, but it was only Lyra dreaming. The witches heard the rumbling of a storm, and they saw the lightning play over the sea and the foothills, but it was a long way off. Later, Ruta Skadi said,
The girl, Lyra, what of the part she was supposed to play? Is this it? She's important because she can lead the boy to his father. It was more than that, wasn't it?
That's what she has to do now. But as for later, yes, far more than that. What we witches have said about the child is that she would put an end to destiny. Well, we know the name that would make her meaningful to Mrs. Coulter, and we know that the woman doesn't know it. The witch she was torturing on the ship near Svalbard nearly gave it away, but Yambe Akka came to her in time. But I'm thinking now that Lyra might be what you heard those ghasts speak of, this Esaheter. Not the witches, not those angel beings, but that sleeping child. The final weapon in the war against the authority. Why else would Mrs. Coulter be so anxious to find her?
Mrs. Coulter was a lover of Lord Asriel's. Of course. And Lyra is their child. Serafina Pekala, if I had borne his child, what a witch she would be. A queen of queens.
Hush, sister. Listen. And what's that light?
They stood, alarmed that something had slipped past their guard, and saw a gleam of light from the camping place. Not firelight, though. Nothing remotely like firelight. They ran back on silent feet, arrows already nocked to their bowstrings, and stopped suddenly. All the witches were asleep on the grass, and so were Will and Lyra. But surrounding the two children were a dozen or more angels, gazing down at them. And then Serafina understood something for which the witches had no word. It was the idea of pilgrimage. She understood why these beings would wait for thousands of years and travel vast distances in order to be close to something important, and how they would feel differently for the rest of time, having been briefly in its presence. That was how these creatures looked now, these beautiful pilgrims of rarefied light, standing around the girl with the dirty face and the tartan skirt, and the boy with the wounded hand who was frowning in his sleep. There was a stir at Lyra's neck. Pantalaimon, a snow-white ermine, opened his black eyes sleepily and gazed around unafraid. Later, Lyra would remember it as a dream. Pantalaimon seemed to accept the attention as Lyra's due, and presently he curled up again and closed his eyes. Finally, one of the creatures spread his wings wide. The others, as close as they were, did so too, and their wings interpenetrated with no resistance, sweeping through one another like light through light, until there was a circle of radiance around the sleepers on the grass. Then the watchers took to the air, one after another, rising like flames into the sky and increasing in size as they did so, until they were immense. But already they were far away, moving like shooting stars towards the north. Serafina and Ruta Skadi sprang to their pine branches and followed them upwards, but they were left far behind.
Were they like the creatures you saw, Ruta Skadi?
Said Serafina as they slowed down in the middle airs, watching the bright flames diminish toward the horizon.
Bigger, I think, but the same kind. They have no flesh. Did you see that? All they are is light. Their senses must be so different from ours. Serafina Pekkala, I'm leaving you now to call all the witches of our north together. When we meet again, it will be wartime. Go well, my dear.
They embraced in midair, and Rutaskadi turned and sped southwards. Serafina watched her go, and then turned to see the last of the gleaming angels disappear far away. She felt nothing but compassion for those great watchers. How much they must miss, never to feel the earth beneath their feet, or the wind in their hair, or the tingle of the starlight on their bare skin. And she snapped a little twig off the pine branch she flew with, and sniffed the sharp resin smell with greedy pleasure before flying slowly down to join the sleepers on the grass. Chapter 14 Alamo Gulch. Lee Scoresby looked down at the placid ocean to his left and the green shore to his right, and shaded his eyes to search for human life. It was a day and a night since they had left the Yenisei.
And this is a new world?
New to those not born in it,
said Stanislaus Grumman.
As old as yours or mine, otherwise. What Asriel's done has shaken everything up, Mr. Scoresby. Shaken it more profoundly than it's ever been shaken before. These doorways and windows that I spoke of, they open in unexpected places now. It's hard to navigate, but this wind is a fair one.
New or old, that's a strange world down there.
Yes, it is a strange world. Though no doubt some feel at home there.
It looks empty.
Not so. Beyond that headland you'll find a city that was once powerful and wealthy, and it's still inhabited by the descendants of the merchants and nobles who built it, though it's fallen on hard times in the past 300 years.
A few minutes later, as the balloon drifted on, Lee saw first a lighthouse, then the curve of a stone breakwater, then the towers and domes and red-brown roofs of a beautiful city around a harbour, with a sumptuous building like an opera house in lush gardens, and wide boulevards with elegant hotels, and little streets where blossom-bearing trees hung over shaded balconies. And Grumman was right. There were people there. But as the balloon drifted closer, Lee was surprised to see that they were children. There was not an adult in sight. And he was even more surprised to see the children had no demons. Yet they were playing on the beach, or running in and out of cafes, or eating and drinking, or gathering bags full of goods from houses and shops. And there was a group of boys who were fighting, and a red-haired girl urging them on, and a little boy throwing stones to smash all the windows of a nearby building. It was like a playground the size of a city, with not a teacher in sight. It was a world of children. But they weren't the only presences there. Lee had to rub his eyes when he saw them first, but there was no doubt about it. Columns of mist, or something more tenuous than mist, a thickening of the air. Whatever they were, the city was full of them. They drifted along the boulevards, they entered houses, they clustered in the squares and courtyards. The children moved among them, unseeing, but not unseen. The farther they drifted over the city, the more Lee could observe the behaviour of these forms. And it was clear that some of the children were of interest to them, and that they followed certain children around. The older children, those who, as far as Lee could see through his telescope, were on the verge of adolescence. There was one boy, a tall, thin youth with a shock of black hair, who was so thickly surrounded by the transparent beings that his very outline seemed to shimmer in the air. They were like flies around meat. And the boy had no idea of it, though from time to time he would brush his eyes or shake his head as if to clear his vision.
What the hell are those things?
The people call them spectres.
What do they do exactly?
You've heard of vampires?
Oh, in tales.
The spectres feast as vampires feast on blood, but the spectres' food is attention, a conscious and informed interest in the world. The immaturity of children is less attractive to them.
They're the opposite of those devils at Bolvanger, then.
On the contrary. Both the oblation board and the spectres of indifference are bewitched by this truth about human beings, that innocence is different from experience. The oblation board fears and hates dust, and the spectres feast on it, but it's dust both of them are obsessed by.
They're clustered around that kid down there.
He's growing up. They'll attack him soon, and then his life will become a blank, indifferent misery. He's doomed.
For Pete's sake, can't we rescue him?
No. The specters would seize us at once. They can't touch us up here. All we can do is watch and fly on.
But where are the adults? You don't tell me the whole world is full of children alone.
Those children are spectre orphans. There are many gangs of them in this world. They wander about living on what they can find when the adults flee. And there's plenty to find, as you can see. They don't starve. It looks as if a multitude of spectres have invaded this city, and the adults have gone to safety. You notice how few boats there are in the harbour? The children will come to no harm.
Except for the older ones, like that poor kid down there.
Mr. Scoresby, that is the way this world works. And if you want to put an end to cruelty and injustice, you must take me farther on. I have a job to do.
Seems to me...
Lee said, feeling for the words.
Seems to me the place you fight cruelty is where you find it. And the place you give help is where you see it needed. Or is that wrong, Dr. Grumman? I'm only an ignorant aeronaut. I'm so damn ignorant I believed it when I was told that shamans had the gift of flight, for example. Yet here's a shaman who hasn't.
Oh, but I have.
How'd you make that out?
The balloon was drifting lower, and the ground was rising. A square stone tower rose directly in their path, and Lee didn't seem to have noticed.
I needed to fly, so I summoned you. And here I am, flying.
He was perfectly aware of the peril they were in, but he held back from implying that the aeronaut wasn't. And in perfect time, Lee Scoresby leaned over the side of the basket and pulled the cord on one of the bags of ballast. The sand flowed out, and the balloon lifted gently to clear the tower by 6 feet or so. A dozen crows, disturbed, rose cawing around them.
I guess you are. You have a strange way about you, Dr. Grumman. You ever spend any time among the witches?
Yes, and among academicians and among spirits. I found folly everywhere, but there were grains of wisdom in every stream of it. No doubt there was much more wisdom that I failed to recognize. Life is hard, Mr. Scoresby, but we cling to it all the same.
And this journey we're on. Is that folly or wisdom?
The greatest wisdom I know.
Tell me again what your purpose is. You're going to find the bearer of this subtle knife. And what then?
Tell him what his task is.
And that's a task that includes protecting Lyra.
It will protect all of us.
They flew on, and soon the city was out of sight behind them. Lee checked his instruments. The compass was still gyrating loosely, but the altimeter was functioning accurately, as far as he could judge, and showed them to be floating about 1,000 feet above the seashore and parallel with it. Some way ahead, a line of high green hills rose into the haze, and Lee was glad he'd provided plenty of ballast. But when he made his regular scan of the horizon, he felt a little check at his heart. Hester felt it too, and flicked up her ears and turned her head so that one gold hazel eye rested on his face. He picked her up, tucked her in the breast of his coat, and opened the telescope again. No, he wasn't mistaken. Far to the south, if south it was, the direction they'd come from, another balloon was floating in the haze. The heat shimmer and the distance made it impossible to see any details, but the other balloon was larger, and flying higher. Grumman had seen it too.
"Enemies, Mr. Scoresby,"
he said, shading his eyes to peer into the pearly light.
"There can't be a doubt. I'm uncertain whether to lose ballast and go higher, to catch the quicker wind, or stay low and be less conspicuous. And I'm thankful that thing's not a Zeppelin. They could overhaul us in a few hours. No, damn it, Dr. Grumman, I'm going higher. Because if I was in that balloon, I'd have seen this one already. And I'll bet they have keen eyesight."
He set Hester down again and leaned out to jettison 3 bags of ballast. The balloon rose at once, and Lee kept the telescope to his eye. And a minute later he knew for certain they'd been sighted, for there was a stir of movement in the haze which resolved itself into a line of smoke streaking up and away at an angle from the other balloon, and when it was some distance up it burst into a flare. It blazed a deep red for a moment and then dwindled into a patch of grey smoke, but it was a signal as clear as a tocsin in the night.
"Can you summon a stiffer breeze, Dr. Grumman? I'd like to make those hills by nightfall."
For they were leaving the shoreline now, and their course was taking them out over a wide bay 30 or 40 miles across. A range of hills rose on the far side, and now that he'd gained some height, Lee saw that they might more truthfully be called mountains. He turned to Grumman, but found him deep in a trance. The shaman's eyes were closed, and beads of sweat stood out on his forehead as he rocked gently back and forth. A low rhythmic moaning came from his throat, and his demon gripped the edge of the basket, equally entranced. And whether it was the result of gaining height or whether it was the shaman's spell, a breath did stir the air on Lee's face. He looked up to check the gas bag and saw it sway a degree or two, leaning toward the hills. But the breeze that moved them more swiftly was working on the other balloon, too. It was no closer, but neither had they left it behind. And as Lee turned the telescope on it again, he saw darker, smaller shapes behind it in the shimmering distance. They were grouped purposefully, and becoming clearer and more solid every minute.
Zeppelins! Well, there's no hiding out here.
He tried to make an estimate of their distance and a similar calculation about the hills toward which they were flying. Their speed had certainly picked up now, and the breeze was flicking white tips off the waves far below. Grumman sat resting in a corner of the basket while his demon groomed her feathers. His eyes were closed, but Lee knew he was awake.
The situation's like this, Dr. Grumman. I do not want to be caught aloft by those Zeppelins. There ain't no defense. They'd have us down in a minute. Nor do I want to land in the water, by free choice or not. We could float for a while, but they could pick us off with grenades as easy as fishing. So I want to reach those hills and make a landing. I can see some forest now. We can hide among the trees for a spell, maybe a long time. And meanwhile, the sun's going down. We have about 3 hours to sunset, by my calculation. And it's hard to say, but I think those Zeppelins will have closed on us halfway by that time, and we should have gotten to the far shore of this bay. Now, you understand what I'm saying. I'm going to take us up into those hills and then land, because anything else is certain death. They'll have made a connection now between this ring I showed them and the Skraeling I killed on Nova Zembla. And they ain't chasing us this hard to say we left our wallet on the counter. So, sometime tonight, Dr. Grumman, this flight's going to be over. You ever landed in a balloon?
No, but I trust your skill.
I'll try and get as high up that range as I can. It's a question of balance, because the farther we go, the closer they'll be behind us. If I land when they're too close behind, they'll be able to see where we go. But if I take us down too early, we won't find the shelter of those trees. Either way, there's going to be some shooting before long.
Grumman sat impassively, moving a magical token of feathers and beads from one hand to the other in a pattern that Lee could see had some purposeful meaning. His eagle demon's eyes never left the pursuing Zeppelins. An hour went by, and another. Lee chewed an unlit cigar and sipped cold coffee from a tin flask. The sun settled lower in the sky behind them, and Lee could see the long shade of evening creep along the shore of the bay and up the lower flanks of the hills ahead, while the balloon itself and the mountaintops were bathed in gold. And behind them, almost lost in the sunset glare, the little dots of the Zeppelins grew larger and firmer. They had already overtaken the other balloon and could now be easily seen with the naked eye, four of them in line abreast, and across the wide silence of the bay came the sound of their engines, tiny but clear, an insistent mosquito whine. When they were still a few minutes from making the shore at the foot of the hills, Lee noticed something new in the sky behind the Zeppelins. A bank of clouds had been building, and a massive thunderhead reared thousands of feet up into the still bright upper sky. How had he failed to notice? If a storm was coming, the sooner they landed, the better. And then a dark green curtain of rain drifted down and hung from the clouds, and the storm seemed to be chasing the Zeppelins as they were chasing Lee's balloon, for the rain swept along towards them from the sea, and as the sun finally vanished, a mighty flash came from the clouds, and several seconds later a crash of thunder so loud it shook the very fabric of Lee's balloon and echoed back for a long time from the mountains. Then came another flash of lightning, and this time the jagged fork struck down direct from the thunderhead at one of the Zeppelins. In a moment the gas was alight. A bright flower of flame blossomed against the bruised dark clouds, and the craft drifted down slowly, ablaze like a beacon, and floated, still blazing, on the water. Lee let out the breath he'd been holding. Grumman was standing beside him, one hand on the suspension ring, with lines of exhaustion deep in his face.
Did you bring that storm?
Grumman nodded. The sky was now coloured like a tiger. Bands of gold alternated with patches and stripes of deepest brown-black, and the pattern changed by the minute, for the gold was fading rapidly as the brown-black engulfed it. The sea behind was a patchwork of black water and phosphorescent foam, and the last of the burning Zeppelin's flames were dwindling into nothing as it sank. The remaining three, however, were flying on,
buffeted hard but keeping to their course. More lightning flashed around them, and as the storm came closer, Lee began to fear for the gas in his own balloon. One strike could have it tumbling to earth in flames, and he didn't suppose the shaman could control the storm so finely as to avoid that.
Right, Dr. Grumman. I'm going to ignore those zeppelins for now and concentrate on getting us safe into the mountains and on the ground. What I want you to do is sit tight and hold on, and be prepared to jump when I tell you. I'll give you warning, and I'll try to make it as gentle as I can. But landing in these conditions is a matter of luck as much as skill.
I trust you, Mr. Scoresby.
He sat back in a corner of the basket while his demon perched on the suspension ring, her claws dug deep in the leather binding. The wind was blowing them hard now, and the great gas bag swelled and billowed in the gusts. The ropes creaked and strained, but Lee had no fear of their giving way. He let go some more ballast and watched the altimeter closely. In a storm, when the air pressure sank, you had to offset that drop against the altimetric reading, and very often it was a crude rule-of-thumb calculation. Lee ran through the figures, double-checked them, and then released the last of his ballast. The only control he had now was the gas valve. He couldn't go higher. He could only descend. He peered intently through the stormy air and made out the great bulk of the hills, dark against the dark sky. From below there came a roaring, rushing sound, like the crash of surf on a stony beach, but he knew it was the wind tearing through the leaves on the trees. So far already. They were moving faster than he'd thought. And he shouldn't leave it too long before he brought them down. Lee was too cool by nature to rage at fate. His manner was to raise an eyebrow and greet it laconically. But he couldn't help a flicker of despair now, when the one thing he should do, namely fly before the storm and let it blow itself out, was the one thing guaranteed to get them shot down. He scooped up Hester and tucked her securely into his breast, buttoning the canvas coat up close to keep her in. Grumman sat steady and quiet. His demon, wind-torn, clung firmly with her talons deep in the basket rim and her feathers blown erect.
"I'm going to take us down, Dr. Grumman. You should stand and be ready to jump clear. Hold the ring and swing yourself up when I call."
Grumman obeyed. Lee gazed down, ahead, down, ahead, checking each dim glimpse against the next and blinking the rain out of his eyes. For a sudden squall had brought heavy drops at them like handfuls of gravel, and the drumming they made on the gas bag added to the wind's howl and the lash of the leaves below until Lee could hardly even hear the thunder.
"Here we go! You cooked up a fine storm, Mr. Shaman."
He pulled at the gas valve line and lashed it around a cleat to keep it open. As the gas streamed out of the top, invisible, far above, the lower curve of the gas bag withdrew into itself, and a fold, and then another, appeared where there had been a bulging sphere only a minute before. The basket was tossing and lurching so violently it was hard to tell if they were going down, and the gusts were so sudden and wayward that they might easily have been blown a long way skyward without knowing. But after a minute or so, Lee felt a sudden snag and knew the grapnel had caught on a branch. It was only a temporary check, so the branch had broken, but it showed how close they were.
50 feet above the trees!"
The shaman nodded. Then came another snag, more violent, and the two men were thrown hard against the rim of the basket. Lee was used to it and found his balance at once, but the force took Grumman by surprise. However, he didn't lose his grip on the suspension ring, and Lee could see him safely poised, ready to swing himself clear. A moment later came the most jolting shock of all as the grapnel found a branch that held it fast. The basket tilted at once, and a second later was crashing into the treetops, and amid the lashing of wet leaves and the snapping of twigs and the creak of tormented branches, it jolted to a precarious halt.
"Still there, Dr. Grumman?"
Lee called, for it was impossible to see anything.
"Still here, Mr. Scoresby."
"Better keep still for a minute till we see the situation clearly,"
said Lee, for they were wildly swaying in the wind, and he could feel the basket settling with little jerks against whatever was holding them up. There was still a strong sideways pull from the gas bag, which was now nearly empty, but which as a result was catching the wind like a sail. It crossed Lee's mind to cut it loose, but if it didn't fly away altogether, it would hang in the treetops like a banner and give their position away. Much better to take it in if they could. There came another lightning flash, and a second later the thunder crashed. The storm was nearly overhead. The glare showed Lee an oak trunk with a great white scar where a branch had been torn away, but torn only partially, for the basket was resting on it near the point where it was still attached to the trunk.
"I'm going to throw out a rope and climb down. As soon as our feet touch the ground, we can make the next plan."
"I'll follow you, Mr. Scoresby. My demon tells me the ground is 40 feet down."
And Lee was aware of a powerful flutter of wing beats as the eagle demon settled again on the basket rim.
"She can go that far?"
he said, surprised, but put that out of his mind and made the rope secure, first to the suspension ring and then to the branch, so that even if the basket did fall, It wouldn't fall far. Then, with Hester secure in his breast, he threw the rest of the rope over and clambered down till he felt solid ground beneath his feet. The branches grew thick around the trunk. This was a massive tree, a giant of an oak, and Lee muttered a thank you to it as he tugged on the rope to signal to Grumman that he could descend. Was there another sound in the tumult? He listened hard. Yes, the engine of a Zeppelin, maybe more than one, somewhere above. It was impossible to tell how high or in which direction it was flying, but the sound was there for a minute or so, and then it was gone. The shaman reached the ground.
Did you hear it?
Yes, going higher, into the mountains, I think. Congratulations on landing us safely, Mr. Scoresby.
We ain't finished yet. I want to get that gas bag under the canopy before daybreak, or it'll show up our position from miles away. You up to some manual labor, Dr. Grumman?
Tell me what to do.
All right. I'm going back up the rope, and I'll lower some things down to you. One of them's a tent. You can get that set up while I see what I can do up there to hide the balloon.
They labored for a long time, and in peril at one point, when the branch that had been supporting the basket finally broke and pitched Lee down with it. But he didn't fall far, since the gas bag still trailed among the treetops and held the basket suspended. The fall, in fact, made concealing the gas bag easier, since the lower part of it had been pulled down through the canopy. And working by flashes of lightning, tugging and wrenching and hacking, Lee managed to drag the whole body of the balloon down among the lower branches and out of sight. The wind was still beating the treetops back and forth, but the worst of the rain had passed by the time he decided he could do no more. He clambered down and found that the shaman had not only pitched the tent, but had conjured a fire into being, and was brewing some coffee.
"Ah! This done by magic?"
said Lee, soaked and stiff, easing himself down into the tent and taking the mug Grumman handed him.
"No, you can thank the Boy Scouts for this. Do they have Boy Scouts in your world? Be prepared. Of all the ways of starting a fire, the best is dry matches. I never travel without them. We could do worse than this as a campsite, Mr. Scoresby."
"You heard those Zeppelins again?"
Grumman held up his hand. Lee listened, and sure enough, there was that engine sound, easier to make out now that the rain had eased a little.
"They've been over twice now. They don't know where we are, but they know we're here somewhere."
And a minute later, a flickering glow came from somewhere in the direction the Zeppelin had flown. It was less bright than lightning, but it was persistent, and Lee knew it for a flare.
"Best put out the fire, Dr. Grumman. Sorry as I am to do without it. I think that canopy's thick, but you never know. I'm going to sleep now, wet through or not."
"You will be dry by the morning."
He took a handful of wet earth and pressed it down over the flames, and Lee struggled to lie down in the little tent and closed his eyes. Lee had strange and powerful dreams. At one point he was convinced he had awoken to see the shaman sitting cross-legged, wreathed in flames, and the flames were rapidly consuming his flesh to leave only a white skeleton behind, still seated in a mound of glowing ash. Lee looked for Hester in alarm, and found her sleeping, which never happened, for when he was awake, so was she. So when he found her asleep, his laconic, whip-tongued demon looking so gentle and vulnerable, he was moved by the strangeness of it, and he lay down uneasily beside her, awake in his dream, but really asleep. And he dreamed he lay awake for a long time. Another dream focused on Grumman, too. Lee seemed to see the shaman shaking a feather-trimmed rattle and commanding something to obey him. The something Lee saw with a touch of nausea was a specter, like the ones they'd seen from the balloon. It was tall and nearly invisible, and it invoked such a gut-churning revulsion in Lee that he nearly woke in terror. But Grumman was directing it fearlessly, and coming to no harm either, because the thing listened closely to him and then drifted upward like a soap bubble until it was lost in the canopy. Then his exhausting night took another turn, for he was in the cockpit of a Zeppelin watching the pilot. In fact, he was sitting in the co-pilot's seat, and they were cruising over the forest, looking down at the wildly tossing treetops, a wild sea of leaf and branch. Then that spectre was in the cabin with them. Pinioned in his dream, Lee could neither move nor cry out, and he suffered the terror of the pilot as the man became aware of what was happening to him. The spectre was leaning over the pilot and pressing what would be its face to his. His demon, a finch, fluttered and shrieked and tried to pull away, only to fall half-fainting on the instrument panel. The pilot turned his face to Lee and put out a hand, but Lee had no power of movement. The anguish in the man's eyes was wrenching. Something true and living was being drained from him, and his demon fluttered weakly and called in a wild high call, but she was dying. Then she vanished. But the pilot was still alive. His eyes became filmy and dull, and his reaching hand fell back with a limp thud against the throttle. He was alive, but not alive. He was indifferent to everything. And Lee sat and watched helplessly as the Zeppelin flew on directly into a scarp of the mountains that rose up before them. The pilot watched it rear up in the window, but nothing could interest him. Lee pushed back against the seat in horror, but nothing happened to stop it, and at the moment of impact he cried,
"Hester!"
and woke. He was in the tent, safe, and Hester nibbled his chin. He was sweating. The shaman was sitting cross-legged, but a shiver passed over Lee as he saw that the eagle demon was not there near him. Clearly this forest was a bad place, full of haunting phantasms. Then he became aware of the light by which he was seeing the shaman, because the fire was long out, and the darkness of the forest was profound. Some distant flicker picked out the tree trunks and the undersides of dripping leaves, and Lee knew at once what it was. His dream had been true, and a Zeppelin pilot had flown into the hillside.
"Damn, Lee, you're twitching like an aspen leaf. What's the matter with you?"
Hester grumbled and flicked her long ears.
"Ain't you dreaming too, Hester?"
"You ain't dreaming, Lee. You're seeing. If I'd have known you was a seer, I'd have cured you a long while back. Now you cut it out, you hear?"
He rubbed her head with his thumb, and she shook her ears. And without the slightest transition, he was floating in the air alongside the shaman's demon, Sayan Kutur the Osprey. To be in the presence of another man's demon and away from his own affected Lee with a powerful throb of guilt and strange pleasure. They were gliding, as if he too were a bird, on the turbulent updrafts above the forest, and Lee looked around through the dark air, now suffused with a pallid glow from the full moon that occasionally glared through a brief rent in the cloud cover and made the treetops ring with silver. The eagle demon uttered a harsh scream, and from below came in 1,000 different voices the calls of 1,000 birds. The too-woo of owls, the alarm shriek of little sparrows, the liquid music of the nightingale. Sayan Kutur was calling them. And in answer they came. Every bird in the forest, whether they had been gliding in the hunt on silent wings or roosting asleep, they came fluttering upwards in their thousands through the tumbling air. And Lee felt whatever bird nature he was sharing respond with joy to the command of the Eagle Queen, and whatever humanness he had left felt the strangest of pleasures, that of offering eager obedience to a stronger power that was wholly right. And he wheeled and turned with the rest of the mighty flock, 100 different species all turning as one in the magnetic will of the eagle, and saw against the silver cloud rack the hateful dark regularity of a Zeppelin. They all knew exactly what they must do, and they streamed towards the airship, the swiftest reaching it first, but none so swiftly as Sayan Kutur. The tiny wrens and finches, the darting swifts, the silent-winged owls. Within a minute the craft was laden with them, their claws scrabbling for purchase on the oiled silk or puncturing it to gain a hold. They avoided the engine, though some were drawn into it and dashed to pieces by the slicing propellers. Most of the birds simply perched on the body of the Zeppelin, and those that came next seized onto them until they covered not only the whole body of the craft, now venting hydrogen through 1,000 tiny claw holes, but the windows of the cabin too, and the struts and cables. Every square inch of room had a bird, 2 birds, 3 or more, clinging to it. The pilot was helpless. Under the weight of the birds, the craft began to sink farther and farther down, and then another of those sudden, cruel scarps appeared, shouldering up out of the night and, of course, quite invisible to the men inside the Zeppelin, who was swinging their guns wildly and firing at random. At the last moment, Sayan Kutur screamed, and a thunder of wingbeats drowned even the roar of the engine as every bird took off and flew away. And the men in the cabin had 4 or 5 horrified seconds of knowledge before the Zeppelin crashed and burst into flames. Fire. Heat. Flames. Lee woke up again, his body as hot as if he'd been lying in the desert sun. Outside the tent there was still the endless drip, drip of wet leaves on the canvas, but the storm was over. Pale grey light seeped in, and Lee propped himself up to find Hester blinking beside him, and the shaman wrapped in a blanket, so deeply asleep he might have been dead, had not Sayan Kutur been perched asleep on a fallen branch outside. The only sound apart from the drip of water was the normal forest bird song. No engines in the sky, no enemy voices, so Lee thought it might be safe to light the fire, and after a struggle he got it going and brewed some coffee.
"What now, Hester?"
"Depends. There was 4 of those Zeppelins, and he destroyed 3.
"I mean, have we discharged our duty?"
She flicked her ears and said,
"Don't remember no contract."
"It ain't a contractual thing. It's a moral thing."
"We got 1 more Zeppelin to think about before you start fretting about morals, Lee. There's 30, 40 men with guns, all coming for us. Imperial soldiers, what's more. Survival first, morals later.
She was right, of course, and as he sipped the scalding brew and smoked a cigar, with the daylight gradually growing stronger, he wondered what he would do if he were in charge of the one remaining Zeppelin. Withdraw and wait for full daylight, no doubt, and fly high enough to scan the edge of the forest over a wide area so he could see when Lee and Grumman broke cover. The osprey demon Cyan Kurtur awoke and stretched her great wings above where Lee was sitting. Hester looked up and turned her head this way and that, looking at the mighty demon with each golden eye in turn, and a moment later the shaman himself came out of the tent.
Busy night.
A busy day to come. We must leave the forest at once, Mr. Scoresby. They are going to burn it.
Lee looked around incredulously at the soaking vegetation and said,
How?
They have an engine that throws out a kind of naphtha blended with potash, which ignites when it touches water. The Imperial Navy developed it to use in their war with Nippon. If the forest is saturated, it will catch all the more quickly.
You can see that, can you?
As clearly as you saw what happened to the Zeppelins during the night. Pack what you want to carry, and come away now.
Lee rubbed his jaw. The most valuable things he owned were also the most portable, namely the instruments from the balloon. So he retrieved them from the basket, stowed them carefully in a knapsack, and made sure his rifle was loaded and dry. He left the basket, the rigging, and the gas bag where they lay, tangled and twisted among the branches. From now on he was an aeronaut no more, unless by some miracle he escaped with his life and found enough money to buy another balloon. Now he had to move like an insect along the surface of the earth. They smelled the smoke before they heard the flames, because a breeze from the sea was lifting it inland. By the time they reached the edge of the trees, they could hear the fire, a deep and greedy roar.
Why didn't they do this last night? They could have barbecued us in our sleep.
I guess they want to catch us alive,
Grumman replied, stripping a branch of its leaves so he could use it as a walking stick.
And they're waiting to see where we leave the forest.
And sure enough, the drone of the Zeppelin soon became audible, even over the sound of the flames and of their own labored breathing. For they were hurrying now, clambering upwards over roots and rocks and fallen tree trunks, and stopping only to gather breath. Cyan Kurtur, flying high, swooped down to tell them how much progress they were making and how far behind the flames were, though it wasn't long before they could see smoke above the trees behind them, and then a streaming banner of flame. Creatures of the forest, squirrels, birds, wild boar, were fleeing with them, and a chorus of squealings, shriekings, alarm calls of every sort rose around them. The two travellers struggled on towards the edge of the tree line, which was not far ahead, and then they reached it as wave after wave of heat rolled up at them from the roaring billows of flame that now soared 50 feet into the air. Trees blazed like torches, the sap in their veins boiled and split them asunder, the pitch in the conifers caught like naphtha, the twigs seemed to blossom with ferocious orange flowers all in a moment. Gasping, Lee and Grumman forced themselves up the steep slope of rocks and scree. Half the sky was obscured by smoke and heat shimmer, but high above there floated the squat shape of the one remaining Zeppelin. Too far away, Lee thought hopefully, to see them, even through binoculars. The mountainside rose sheer and impassable ahead of them. There was only one route out of the trap they were in, and that was a narrow defile ahead, where a dry riverbed emerged from a fold in the cliffs. Lee pointed, and Grumman said,
My thoughts exactly, Mr. Scoresby.
His demon, gliding and circling above, tipped her wings and sped to the ravine on a billowing updraft. The men didn't pause, climbing on as quickly as they could. But Lee said,
Excuse me for asking this if it's impertinent, but I never knew anyone whose demon could do that except witches. But you're no witch. Was that something you learned to do, or did it come natural?
For a human being, nothing comes naturally. We have to learn everything we do. Cyan Kurtur is telling me that the ravine leads to a pass. If we get there before they see us, we could escape yet.
The eagle swooped down again and the men climbed higher. Hester preferred to find her own way over the rocks, so Lee followed where she led, avoiding the loose stones and moving as swiftly as he could over the larger rocks, making all the time for the little gulch. Lee was anxious about Grumman, because the other man was pale and drawn and breathing hard. His labours in the night had drained a lot of his energy. How far they could keep going was a question Lee didn't want to face, but when they were nearly at the entrance to the ravine, and actually on the edge of the dried riverbed, he heard a change in the sound of the Zeppelin.
They've seen us.
And it was like receiving a sentence of death. Hester stumbled. Even sure-footed, firm-hearted Hester stumbled and faltered. Grumman leaned on the stick he carried and shaded his eyes to look back, and Lee turned to look too. The Zeppelin was descending fast, making for the slope directly below them. It was clear that the pursuers intended to capture them, not kill them, for a burst of gunfire just then would have finished both of them in a second. Instead, the pilot brought the airship skillfully to a hover just above the ground, at the highest point in the slope where he safely could, and from the cabin door a stream of blue-uniformed men jumped down, their wolf demons beside them, and began to climb. Lee and Grumman were 600 yards above them, and not far from the entrance to the ravine. Once they reached it, they could hold the soldiers off as long as their ammunition held out. But they had only one rifle.
They're after me, Mr. Scoresby, not you. If you give me the rifle and surrender yourself, you'll survive. They're disciplined troops. You'll be a prisoner of war.
Lee ignored that and said,
Get moving. Make the gulch, and I'll hold them off from the mouth while you find your way out the other end. I brought you this far, and I ain't going to sit back and let them catch you now.
The men below were moving up quickly, for they were fit and rested. Grumman nodded.
I had no strength left to bring the fourth one down,
was all he said, and they moved quickly into the shelter of the gulch.
Just tell me before you go, because I won't be easy till I know. What side I'm fighting for, I can't tell, and I don't greatly care. Just tell me this. What I'm going to do now, is that going to help that little girl, Lyra, or harm her?
It's going to help her.
And your oath. You won't forget what you swore to me.
I won't forget.
Because Dr. Grumman, or John Parry, or whatever name you take up in whatever world you end up in, you be aware of this. I love that little child like a daughter. If I'd had a child of my own, I couldn't love her more. And if you break that oath, whatever remains of me will pursue whatever remains of you, and you'll spend the rest of eternity wishing you never existed. That's how important that oath is.
I understand. And you have my word.
Then that's all I need to know. Go well.
The shaman held out his hand, and Lee shook it. Then Grumman turned and made his way up the gulch, and Lee looked around for the best place to make his stand.
Not the big boulder, Lee. You can't see to the right from there, and they could rush us. Take the smaller one.
There was a roaring in Lee's ears that had nothing to do with the conflagration in the forest below, or with the laboring drone of the Zeppelin trying to rise again. It had to do with his childhood and the Alamo. How often he and his companions had played that heroic battle in the ruins of the old fort, taking turns to be Danes and French. His childhood was coming back to him with a vengeance. He took out the Navajo ring of his mother's and laid it on the rock beside him. In the old Alamo games, Hester had often been a cougar or a wolf, and once or twice a rattlesnake, but mostly a mockingbird. Now...
Quit daydreaming and take a sight. This ain't play, Lee.
The men climbing the slope had fanned out and were moving more slowly because they saw the problem as well as he did. They knew they'd have to capture the gulch, and they knew that one man with a rifle could hold them off for a long time. Behind them, to Lee's surprise, the Zeppelin was still laboring to rise. Maybe its buoyancy was going, or maybe the fuel was running low, but either way it hadn't taken off yet, and it gave him an idea. He adjusted his position and sighted along the old Winchester until he had the port engine mounting, plumb in view, and fired. The crack raised the soldiers' heads as they climbed towards him, but a second later the engine suddenly roared and then just as suddenly ceased and died. The Zeppelin lurched over to one side. Lee could hear the other engine howling, but the airship was grounded now. The soldiers had halted and taken cover as well as they could. Lee could count them, and he did. 25. He had 30 bullets. Hester crept up close to his left shoulder.
I'll watch this way.
Crouched on the grey boulder, her ears flat along her back, she looked like a little stone herself, grey-brown and inconspicuous except for her eyes. Hester was no beauty. She was about as plain and scrawny as her hair could be, but her eyes were marvellously coloured, gold-hazel flecked with rays of deepest peat-brown and forest green. And now those eyes were looking down at the last landscape they'd ever see, a barren slope of brutal, tumbled rocks, and beyond it a forest on fire. Not a blade of grass, not a speck of green to rest on. Her ears flicked slightly.
They're talking. I can hear, but I can't understand.
Russian. They're going to come up all together and not a run. That would be hardest for us, so they'll do that.
Aim straight.
I will. But hell, I don't like taking lives, Hester.
ours or theirs.
No, it's more than that. It's theirs or Lyra's. I can't see how, but we're connected to that child, and I'm glad of it.
There's a man on the left about to shoot,
said Hester. And as she spoke, a crack came from his rifle and chips of stone flew off the boulder a foot from where she crouched. The bullet whined off into the gulch, but she didn't move a muscle.
Well, that makes me feel better about doing this,
said Lee, and took careful aim. He fired. There was only a small patch of blue to aim at, but he hit it. With a surprised cry, the man fell back and died. And then the fight began. Within a minute, the crack of rifles, the whine of ricocheting bullets, the smash of pulverizing rock echoed and rang the length of the mountainside and along the hollow gulch behind. The smell of cordite and the burning smell that came from the powdered rock where the bullets hit were just variations on the smell of burning wood from the forest, until it seemed that the whole world was burning. Lee's boulder was soon scarred and pitted, and he felt the thud of the bullets as they hit it. Once he saw the fur on Hester's back ripple as the wind of a bullet passed over it, but she didn't budge, nor did he stop firing. That first minute was fierce, and after it, in the pause that came, Lee found that he was wounded. There was blood on the rock under his cheek, and his right hand and the rifle bolt were red. Hester moved around to look.
Nothing big. A bullet clipped your scalp.
Did you count how many fell, Hester?
No. Too busy ducking. Reload while you can, boy.
He rolled down behind the rock and worked the bolt back and forth. It was hot, and the blood that had flowed freely over it from the scalp wound was drying and making the mechanism stiff. He spat on it carefully, and it loosened. Then he hauled himself back into position, and even before he'd set his eye to the sight, he took a bullet. It felt like an explosion in his left shoulder. For a few seconds he was dazed, and then he came to his senses with his left arm numb and useless. There was a great deal of pain waiting to spring on him, but it hadn't raised the courage yet, and that thought gave him the strength to focus his mind on shooting again. He propped the rifle on the dead and useless arm that had been so full of life a minute ago, and sighted with stolid concentration. One shot, two, three, and each found its man.
How we doing?
Good shooting,
she whispered back, very close to his cheek.
Don't stop. Over by that black boulder.
He looked, aimed, shot. The figure fell.
Damn, these are men like me.
Makes no sense. Do it anyway.
Do you believe him, Grumman?
Sure. Plumb ahead, Lee.
Crack. Another man fell and his demon went out like a candle. Then there was a long silence. Lee fumbled in his pocket and found some more bullets. As he reloaded, he felt something so rare his heart nearly failed. He felt Hester's face pressed to his own, and it was wet with tears.
Lee, this is my fault.
Why?
The Skraeling. I told you to take his ring. Without that, we'd never be in this trouble.
You think I ever did what you told me? I took it because the witch...
He didn't finish because another bullet found him. This time it smashed into his left leg, and before he could even blink, a third one clipped his head again like a red-hot poker laid along his skull.
Not long now, Hester,
he muttered, trying to hold still.
The witch, Lee. You said the witch. Remember?
Poor Hester, she was lying now, not crouching, tense and watchful as she'd done all his adult life, and her beautiful gold-brown eyes were growing dull.
Still beautiful. Oh, Hester, yeah, the witch. She gave me...
Sure she did. The flower.
In my breast pocket. Fetch it, Hester, I can't move.
It was a hard struggle, but she tugged out the little scarlet flower with her strong teeth and laid it by his right hand. With a great effort, he closed it in his fist and said,
Serafina Pecola, help me! I beg!
A movement below. He let go of the flower, sighted, fired. The movement died. Hester was failing.
Hester, don't you go before I do.
Lee, I couldn't abide to be anywhere away from you for a single second.
You think the witch will come?
Sure she will. We should have called her before.
We should have done a lot of things.
Maybe so.
Another crack, and this time the bullet went deep somewhere inside, seeking out the center of his life. He thought, it won't find it there. Hester's my center. And he saw a blue flicker down below and strained to bring the barrel over to it.
He's the one.
Lee found it hard to pull the trigger. Everything was hard. He had to try three times, and finally he got it. The blue uniform tumbled away down the slope. Another long silence.
The pain nearby was losing its fear of him. It was like a pack of jackals, circling, sniffing, treading closer, and he knew they wouldn't leave him now till they'd eaten him bare.
There's one man left. He's a-making for the Zeppelin.
And Lee saw him mistily, one soldier of the Imperial Guard creeping away from his company's defeat.
I can't shoot a man in the back.
Shame to die with one bullet left, though.
So he took aim with his last bullet at the Zeppelin itself, still roaring and straining to rise with its one engine, and the bullet must have been red-hot, or maybe a burning brand from the forest below was wafted to the airship on an updraft, for the gas suddenly billowed into an orange fireball, and the envelope and the metal skeleton rose a little way and then tumbled down very slowly, gently, but full of a fiery death. And the man creeping away, and the six or seven others who were the only remnant of the guard, and who hadn't dared come closer to the man holding the ravine, were engulfed by the fire that fell on them. Lee saw the fireball and heard through the roar in his ears Hester saying,
"That's all of them, Lee,"
he said, or thought.
"Those poor men didn't have to come to this, nor did we."
"We held them off. We held out. We're a-helpin' Lyra."
Then she was pressing her little, proud, broken self against his face, as close as she could get. And then they died.
Chapter 15. Blood Moss.
"On," said the alethiometer. "Farther. Higher." So on they climbed. The witches flew above to spy out the best routes, because the hilly land soon gave way to steeper slopes and rocky footing. And as the sun rose towards noon, the travellers found themselves in a tangled land of dry gullies, cliffs, and boulder-strewn valleys where not a single green leaf grew, and where the stridulation of insects was the only sound. They moved on, stopping only for sips of water from their goatskin flasks, and talking little. Pantalaimon flew above Lyra's head for a while until he tired of that, and then he became a little sure-footed mountain sheep, vain of his horns, leaping among rocks while Lyra scrambled laboriously alongside. Will moved on grimly, screwing up his eyes against the glare, ignoring the worsening pain from his hand, and finally reaching a state in which movement alone was good and stillness bad, so that he suffered more from resting than from toiling on. And since the failure of the witch's spell to stop his bleeding, he thought they were regarding him with fear too, as if he was marked by some curse greater than their own powers. At one point they came to a little lake, a patch of intense blue scarcely 30 yards across among the red rocks. They stopped there to drink and refill their flasks, and to soak their aching feet in the icy water. They stayed a few minutes and moved on, and soon afterwards, when the sun was at its highest and hottest, Serafina Pekala darted down to speak to them. She was agitated.
"I must leave you for a while. Lee Scoresby needs me. I don't know why, but he wouldn't call if he didn't need my help. Keep going, and I'll find you."
"Mr. Scoresby, but where..."
But Serafina was gone, speeding out of sight before Lyra could finish the question. Lyra reached automatically for the alethiometer to ask what had happened to Lee Scoresby, but she let her hand drop, because she'd promised to do no more than guide Will. She looked across to him. He was sitting nearby, his hand held loosely on his knee and still slowly dripping blood, his face scorched by the sun and pale under the burning.
"Will... do you know why you have to find your father?"
"It's what I've always known. My mother said I'd take up my father's mantle, that's all I know."
"What does that mean? Taking up his mantle? What's a mantle?"
"A task, I suppose. Whatever he's been doing, I've got to carry on. Makes as much sense as anything else."
He wiped the sweat out of his eyes with his right hand. What he couldn't say was that he longed for his father as a lost child yearns for home. That comparison wouldn't have occurred to him, because home was the place he kept safe for his mother, not the place others kept safe for him. But it had been 5 years now since that Saturday morning in the supermarket, when the pretend game of hiding from the enemies became desperately real. Such a long time in his life, and his heart craved to hear the words, "Well done, my child."
No one on earth could have done better. I'm proud of you. Come and rest now. Will longed for that so much that he hardly knew he did. It was just part of what everything felt like. So he couldn't express that to Lyra now, though she could see it in his eyes, and that was new for her, too, to be quite so perceptive. The fact was that where Will was concerned, she was developing a new kind of sense, as if he were simply more in focus than anyone she'd known before. Everything about him was clear and close and immediate. And she might have said that to him, but at that moment a witch flew down.
I can see people behind us. They're a long way back, but they're moving quickly. Shall I go closer and look?
Yes, do. But fly low and hide, and don't let them see you.
Will and Lyra got painfully to their feet again and clambered on.
I've been cold plenty of times,
Lyra said, to take her mind off the pursuers.
But I ain't been this hot ever. Is it this hot in your world?
Not where I used to live. Not normally. But the climate's been changing. The summers are hotter than they used to be. They say that people have been interfering with the atmosphere by putting chemicals in it, and the weather's going out of control.
Yeah, well, they have, and it is. And we're here in the middle of it.
He was too hot and thirsty to reply, and they climbed on breathlessly in the throbbing air. Pantalaimon was a cricket now and sat on Lyra's shoulder, too tired to leap or fly. From time to time the witches would see a spring high up, too high to climb to, and fly up to fill the children's flasks. They would soon have died without water, and there was none where they were. Any spring that made its way into the air was soon swallowed again among the rocks, and so they moved on towards evening. The witch who flew back to spy was called Lena Felt. She flew low from crag to crag, and as the sun was setting and drawing a wild blood red out of the rocks, she came to the little blue lake and found a troop of soldiers making camp. But her first glimpse of them told her more than she wanted to know. These soldiers had no demons. And they weren't from Will's world, or the world of Chitagatse, where people's demons were inside them and where they still looked alive. These men were from her own world, and to see them without demons was a gross and sickening horror. Then, out of a tent by the lakeside, came the explanation. Lena Felt saw a woman, a short life, graceful in her khaki hunting clothes and as full of life as the golden monkey who capered along the water's edge beside her. Lena Felt hid among the rocks above and watched as Mrs. Coulter spoke to the officer in charge and as his men put up tents, made fires, boiled water. The witch had been among Serafina Pekala's troop who rescued the children at Bolvanger, and she longed to shoot Mrs. Coulter on the spot. But some fortune was protecting the woman, for it was just too far for a bow shot from where she was, and the witch could get no closer without making herself invisible. So she began to make the spell. It took 10 minutes of deep concentration. Confident at last, Lena Felt went down the rocky slope towards the lake, and as she walked through the camp, one or two blank-eyed soldiers glanced up briefly, but found what they saw too hard to remember, and looked away again. The witch stopped outside the tent Mrs. Coulter had gone into, and fitted an arrow to her bowstring. She listened to the low voice through the canvas, and then moved carefully to the open flap that overlooked the lake. Inside the tent, Mrs. Coulter was talking to a man Lena Felt hadn't seen before. An older man, grey-haired and powerful, with a serpent demon twined around his wrist. He was sitting in a canvas chair beside hers, and she was leaning towards him, speaking softly.
Of course, Carlyle. I'll tell you anything you like. What do you want to know?
How do you command the spectres? I didn't think it possible, but you have them following you like dogs. Are they afraid of your bodyguard? What is it?
Simple. They know I can give them more nourishment if they let me live than if they consume me. I can lead them to all the victims their phantom hearts desire. As soon as you described them to me, I knew I could dominate them. And so it turns out. And a whole world trembles in the power of these pallid things. But, Carlyle, I can please you too, you know. Would you like me to please you even more?
Marisa, it's enough of a pleasure to be close to you.
No, it isn't, Carlo. You know it isn't. You know I can please you more than this.
Her demon's little black horny hands were stroking the serpent demon. Little by little, the serpent loosened herself and began to flow along the man's arm towards the monkey. Both the man and the woman were holding glasses of golden wine, and she sipped hers and leaned a little closer to him. said the man as the demon slipped slowly off his arm and let her weight into the golden monkey's hands. The monkey raised her slowly to his face and ran his cheek softly along her emerald skin. Her tongue flicked blackly this way and that, and the man sighed.
Carlo, tell me why you're pursuing the boy,
Mrs. Coulter whispered, and her voice was as soft as the monkey's caress.
Why do you need to find him?
He has something I want. Oh, Marisa.
What is it, Carlo? What's he got?
He shook his head, but he was finding it hard to resist. His demon was twined gently around the monkey's breast and running her head through and through the long, lustrous fur as his hands moved along her fluid length. Lena Felt watched them, standing invisible just 2 paces from where they sat. Her bowstring was taut, the arrow knocked to it in readiness. She could have pulled and loosed in less than a second, and Mrs. Coulter would have been dead before she finished drawing breath. But the witch was curious. She stood still and silent and wide-eyed. But while she was watching Mrs. Coulter, she didn't look behind her across the little blue lake. On the far side of it in the darkness, a grove of ghostly trees seemed to have planted itself, a grove that shivered every so often with a tremor like a conscious intention. But they were not trees, of course. And while all the curiosity of Lena Felt and her demon was directed at Mrs. Coulter, one of the pallid forms detached itself from its fellows and drifted across the surface of the icy water, causing not a single ripple, until it paused a foot from the rock on which Lena Felt's demon was perched.
You could easily tell me, Carlo. You could whisper it. You could pretend to be talking in your sleep, and who could blame you for that? Just tell me what the boy has and why you want it. I could get it for you. Wouldn't you like me to do that? Just tell me, Carlo. I don't want it. I want the girl. What is it? Just tell me and you shall have it.
He gave a soft shudder. His eyes were closed. Then he said,
It's a knife. The subtle knife of Chitagatse. You haven't heard of it, Marisa. Some people call it Teleutaire Makaira, the last knife of all. Others call it Asa Heta.
What does it do, Carlo? Why is it special?
It's the knife that will cut anything. Not even its makers knew what it could do. Nothing, no one, matter, spirit, angel, air. Nothing is invulnerable to the subtle knife. Marisa, it's mine. You understand?
Of course, Carlo, I promise. Let me fill your glass.
And as the golden monkey slowly ran his hands along the emerald serpent again and again, squeezing just a little, lifting, stroking as Sir Charles sighed with pleasure, Lena Felt saw what was truly happening. Because while the man's eyes were closed, Mrs. Coulter secretly tilted a few drops from a small flask into the glass before filling it again with wine.
Here, darling. Let's drink. To each other.
He was already intoxicated. He took the glass and sipped greedily, once, again, and again. And then, without any warning, Mrs. Coulter stood up and turned and looked Lena Felt full in the face.
Well, witch, did you think I don't know how you make yourself invisible?
Lena Felt was too surprised to move. Behind her, the man was struggling to breathe. His chest was heaving, his face was red, and his demon was limp and fainting in the monkey's hands. The monkey shook her off in contempt. Lena Felt tried to swing her bow up, but a fatal paralysis had touched her shoulder. She couldn't make herself do it. This had never happened before, and she uttered a little cry.
Oh, it's too late for that. Look at the lake, witch.
Lena Felt turned and saw her snow-bunting demon fluttering and shrieking as if he were in a glass chamber that was being emptied of air, fluttering and falling, slumping, failing, his beak opening wide, gasping in panic. The spectre had enveloped him. She cried, and tried to move towards it, but was driven back by a spasm of nausea. Even in her sickened distress, Lena Felt could see that Mrs. Coulter had more force in her soul than anyone she had ever seen. It didn't surprise her to see that the spectre was under Mrs. Coulter's power. No one could resist that authority. Lena Felt turned back in anguish to the woman.
Let him go! Please, let him go!
We'll see. Is the child with you, the girl, Lyra?
Yes!
And a boy, too, a boy with a knife?
Yes, I beg you!
And how many witches have you?
20! Let him go, let him go!
All in the air, or do some of you stay on the ground with the children?
Most in the air, 3 or 4 on the ground, always. This is anguish! Let him go, or kill me now!
How far up the mountain are they? Are they moving on, or have they stopped to rest?
Lena Felt told her everything. She could have resisted any torture but what was happening to her demon now. When Mrs. Coulter had learned all she wanted to know about where the witches were and how they guarded Lyra and Will, she said,
"And now tell me this. You witches know something about the child Lyra. I nearly learned it from one of your sisters, but she died before I could complete the torture. Well, there is no one to save you now. Tell me the truth about my daughter."
"She will be the mother. She will be life. Mother, she will disobey. She will..."
"Name her! You are saying everything but the most important thing. Name her!"
"Eve! Mother of all! Eve again! Mother Eve!"
"Ah!"
said Mrs. Coulter, and she breathed a great sigh as if the purpose of her life was clear to her at last. Dimly the witch saw what she had done, and through the horror that was enveloping her she tried to cry out,
"What will you do to her? What will you do?"
"Why, I shall have to destroy her, to prevent another fall. Why didn't I see this before? It was too large to see."
She clapped her hands together softly like a child, wide-eyed. Lena felt, whimpering, heard her go on,
"Of course. Asriel will make war on the Authority, and then... Of course, of course. As before, so again. And Lyra is Eve. And this time she will not fall. I'll see to that."
And Mrs. Coulter drew herself up and snapped her fingers to the spectre feeding on the witch's demon. The little snow-bunting demon lay twitching on the rock as the spectre moved towards the witch herself. And then whatever Lena felt had undergone before was doubled and trebled and multiplied a hundredfold. She felt a nausea of the soul, a hideous and sickening despair, a melancholy weariness so profound that she was going to die of it. Her last conscious thought was disgust at life. Her senses had lied to her. The world was not made of energy and delight, but of foulness, betrayal, and lassitude. Living was hateful, and death was no better, and from end to end of the universe this was the first and last and only truth. Thus she stood, bow in hand, indifferent, dead in life. So Lena Felt failed to see or to care about what Mrs. Coulter did next. Ignoring the grey-haired man slumped unconscious in the canvas chair and his dull-skinned demon coiled in the dust, the woman called the captain of the soldiers and ordered them to get ready for a night march up the mountain. Then she went to the edge of the water and called to the spectres. They came at her command, gliding like pillars of mist across the water. She raised her arms and made them forget they were earthbound, so that one by one they rose into the air and floated free like malignant thistledown, drifting up into the night and borne by the air currents towards Will and Lyra and the other witches. But Lena Felt saw nothing of it. The temperature dropped quickly after dark, and when Will and Lyra had eaten the last of their dry bread, they lay down under an overhanging rock to keep warm and try to sleep. At least Lyra didn't have to try. She was unconscious in less than a minute, curled tightly around Pantalaimon. But Will couldn't find sleep, no matter how long he lay there. It was partly his hand, which was now throbbing right up to the elbow and uncomfortably swollen, and partly the hard ground, and partly the cold, and partly utter exhaustion, and partly his longing for his mother. He was afraid for her, of course, and he knew she'd be safer if he was there to look after her. But he wanted her to look after him, too, as she'd done when he was very small. He wanted her to bandage him, and tuck him into bed, and sing to him, and take away all the trouble, and surround him with all the warmth and softness and mother kindness he needed so badly. And it was never going to happen. Part of him was only a little boy still. So he cried, but he lay very still as he did, not wanting to wake Lyra. But he still wasn't asleep. He was more awake than ever. Finally he uncurled his stiff limbs and got up quietly, shivering, and with a knife at his waist he set off higher up the mountain to calm his restlessness. Behind him the sentry witch's Robin demon cocked his head, and she turned from the watch she was keeping to see Will clambering up the rocks. She reached for her pine branch and silently took to the air, not to disturb him, but to see that he came to no harm. He didn't notice. He felt such a need to move and keep moving that he hardly noticed the pain in his hand any more. He felt as if he should walk all night, all day, forever, because nothing else would calm this fever in his breast. And as if in sympathy with him, a wind was rising. There were no leaves to stir in this wilderness, but the air buffeted his body and made his hair stream away from his face. It was wild outside him and wild within. He climbed higher and higher, hardly once thinking of how he might find his way back down to Lyra, until he came out on a little plateau almost at the top of the world, it seemed. All around him, on every horizon, the mountains reached no higher. In the brilliant glare of the moon, the only colours were stark black and dead white, and every edge was jagged and every surface bare. The wild wind must have been bringing clouds overhead, because suddenly the moon was covered, and darkness swept over the whole landscape. Thick clouds, too, for no gleam of moonlight shone through them. In less than a minute, Will found himself in nearly total darkness. And at the same moment, Will felt a grip on his right arm. He cried out with shock and twisted away at once, but the grip was tenacious. And Will was savage now. He felt he was at the very end of everything. And if it was the end of his life, too, he was going to fight and fight till he fell. So he twisted and kicked and twisted again, but that hand wouldn't let go. And since it was his right arm being held, he couldn't get at the knife. He tried with his left, but he was being jerked around so much, and his hand was so painful and swollen that he couldn't reach. He had to fight with one bare, wounded hand against a grown man. He sank his teeth into the hand on his forearm, but all that happened was that the man landed a dizzying blow on the back of his head. Then Will kicked again and again, and some of the kicks connected and some didn't, and all the time he was pulling, jerking, twisting, shoving, and still the grip held him fast. Dimly he heard his own panting and the man's grunts and harsh breathing, and then by chance he got his leg behind the man's and hurled himself against his chest, and the man fell with Will on top of him, heavily. But never for a moment did that grip slacken, and Will, rolling around violently on the stony ground, felt a heavy fear tighten around his heart. This man would never let him go, and even if he killed him, his corpse would still be holding fast. But Will was weakening, and now he was crying too, sobbing bitterly as he kicked and tugged and beat at the man with his head and feet, and he knew his muscles would give up soon. And then he noticed that the man had fallen still, though his hand still gripped as tight as ever. He was lying there letting Will batter at him with knees and head, and as soon as Will saw that, the last of his strength left him, and he fell helpless beside his opponent, every nerve in his body ringing and dizzy and throbbing. Will hauled himself up painfully, peered through the deep darkness, and made out a blur of white on the ground beside the man. It was the white breast and head of a great bird, an osprey, a demon, and it was lying still. Will tried to pull away, and his feeble tug woke a response from the man, whose hand hadn't loosened. But he was moving. He was feeling Will's right hand carefully with his free one. Will's hair stood on end. Then the man said,
"Give me your other hand."
"Be careful."
The man's free hand felt down Will's left arm, and his fingertips moved gently over the wrist and onto the swollen palm and with the utmost delicacy onto the stumps of Will's two lost fingers. His other hand let go at once, and he sat up.
"You've got the knife. You're the knife-bearer."
His voice was resonant, harsh, but breathless. Will sensed that he was badly hurt. Had he wounded this dark opponent? Will was still lying on the stones, utterly spent. All he could see was the man's shape crouching above him, but he couldn't see his face. The man was reaching sideways for something, and after a few moments a marvellous, soothing coolness spread into his hand from the stumps of his fingers as the man massaged a salve into his skin.
"What are you doing?"
"Curing your wound. Keep still."
"Who are you?"
"I am the only man who knows what the knife is for. Hold your hand up like that. Don't move."
The wind was beating more wildly than ever, and a drop or two of rain splashed onto Will's face. He was trembling violently, but he propped up his left hand with his right while the man spread more ointment over the stumps and wound a strip of linen tightly around the hand. And as soon as the dressing was secure, the man slumped sideways and lay down himself. Will, still bemused by the blessed cool numbness in his hand, tried to sit up and look at him. But it was darker than ever. He felt forward with his right hand and found himself touching the man's chest, where the heart was beating like a bird against the bars of a cage.
"Yes. Try and cure that. Go on."
"You will."
"I'll be better soon. You have the knife, yes?"
"Yes."
"And you know how to use it?"
"Yes. Yes, but are you from this world? How do you know about it?"
"Listen,"
said the man, sitting up with a struggle.
"Don't interrupt. If you're the bearer of the knife, you have a task that's greater than you can imagine. A child. How could they let it happen? Well, so it must be. There is a war coming, boy. The greatest war there ever was. Something like it happened before, and this time the right side must win. We've had nothing but lies and propaganda and cruelty and deceit for all the thousands of years of human history. It's time we started again, but properly this time.
He stopped to take in several rattling breaths.
The knife,
he went on after a minute.
They never knew what they were making, those old philosophers. They invented a device that could split open the very smallest particles of matter, and they used it to steal candy. They had no idea that they'd made the one weapon in all the universes that could defeat the tyrant, the authority, God. The rebel angels fell because they didn't have anything like the knife. But now...
I didn't want it. I don't want it now. If you want it, you can have it. I hate it, and I hate what it does.
Too late. You haven't any choice. You're the bearer. It's picked you out. And what's more, they know you've got it. And if you don't use it against them, they'll tear it from your hands and use it against the rest of us forever and ever.
But why should I fight them? I've been fighting too much. I can't go on fighting. I want to...
Have you won your fights?
Will was silent. Then he said...
Yes, I suppose.
You fought for the knife.
Yes, but...
Then you're a warrior. That's what you are. Argue with anything else, but don't argue with your own nature.
Will knew that the man was speaking the truth. But it wasn't a welcome truth. It was heavy and painful. The man seemed to know that because he let Will bow his head before he spoke again.
There are two great powers... And they've been fighting since time began. Every advance in human life, every scrap of knowledge and wisdom and decency we have, has been torn by one side from the teeth of the other. Every little increase in human freedom has been fought over ferociously between those who want us to know more and be wiser and stronger, and those who want us to obey and be humble and submit. And now, those two powers are lining up for battle. And each of them wants that knife of yours more than anything else. You have to choose, boy. We've been guided here, both of us. You with the knife, and me to tell you about it.
No, you're wrong. I wasn't looking for anything like that. That's not what I was looking for at all.
You might not think so, but that's what you've found.
But what must I do?
And then Stanislaus Krumman, John Parry, hesitated. He was painfully aware of the oath he'd sworn to Lee Scoresby, and he hesitated before he broke it. But break it he did.
You must go to Lord Asriel and tell him that Stanislaus Krumman sent you, and that you have the one weapon he needs above all others. Like it or not, boy, you have a job to do. Ignore everything else, no matter how important it seems, and go and do this. Someone will appear to guide you. The night is full of angels. Your wound will heal now. Wait. Before you go, I want to look at you properly.
He felt for the pack he'd been carrying and took something out, unfolding layers of oilskin and then striking a match to light a little tin lantern. In its light, through the rain-dashed windy air, the two looked at each other. Will saw blazing blue eyes and a haggard face with several days' growth of beard on the stubborn jaw. Grey-haired, drawn with pain, a thin body hunched in a heavy cloak trimmed with feathers. The shaman saw a boy even younger than he'd thought, his slim body shivering in a torn linen shirt, and his expression exhausted and savage and weary, but alight with a wild curiosity, his eyes wide under the straight black brows, so like his mother's. And there came just the first flicker of something else to both of them. But in that same moment, as the lantern light flared over John Parry's face, something shot down from the turbid sky and he fell back dead before he could say a word, an arrow in his failing heart. The osprey demon vanished in a moment. Will could only sit stupefied. A flicker crossed the corner of his vision and his right hand darted up at once and he found he was clutching a robin, a demon, red-breasted, panicking.
No! No!
cried the witch Jutta-Kamainen, and fell down after him, clutching at her own heart, crashing clumsily into the rocky ground and struggling up again. But Will was there before she could find her feet, and the subtle knife was at her throat.
Why did you do that? Why did you kill him?
Because I loved him and he scorned me. I am a witch. I don't forgive.
And because she was a witch, she wouldn't have been afraid of a boy normally. But she was afraid of Will. This young wounded figure held more force and danger than she'd ever met in a human before, and she quailed. She fell backwards and he followed and gripped her hair with his left hand, feeling no pain, feeling only an immense and shattering despair.
You don't know who he was. He was my father.
She shook her head and whispered,
No, no, that can't be true. Impossible.
You think things have to be possible. Things have to be true. He was my father, and neither of us knew it till the second you killed him. Witch, I wait all my life and come all this way, and I find him at last, and you kill him.
And he shook her head like a rag and threw her back against the ground, half stunning her. Her astonishment was almost greater than her fear of him, which was real enough, and she pulled herself up, dazed, and seized his shirt in supplication. He knocked her hand away.
What did he ever do that you needed to kill him? Tell me that if you can.
And she looked at the dead man. Then she looked back at Will and shook her head sadly.
No, I can't explain. You're too young. It wouldn't make sense to you. I loved him, that's all. That's enough.
And before Will could stop her, she fell softly sideways, her hand on the hilt of the knife she had just taken from her own belt and pushed between her ribs. Will felt no horror, only desolation and bafflement. He stood up slowly and looked down at the dead witch, at her rich black hair, her flushed cheeks, her smooth pale limbs wet with rain, her lips parted like a lover's.
I don't understand. It's too strange.
Will turned back to the dead man, his father. A thousand things jostled at his throat, and only the dashing rain cooled the hotness in his eyes. The little lantern still flickered and flared as the draught through the ill-fitting window licked around the flame, and by its light Will knelt and put his hands on the man's body, touching his face, his shoulders, his chest, closing his eyes, pushing the wet grey hair off his forehead, pressing his hands to the rough cheeks, closing his father's mouth, squeezing his hands.
Father? Dad? Daddy? Father? I don't understand why she did that. It's too strange for me. But whatever you wanted me to do, I promise, I swear I'll do it. I'll fight. I'll be a warrior. I will. This knife. I'll take it to Lord Asriel, wherever he is, and I'll help him fight that enemy. I'll do it. You can rest now. It's all right. You can sleep now.
Beside the dead man lay his deerskin pack with the oilskin and the lantern and the little horn box of blood moss ointment. Will picked them up, and then he noticed his father's feather-trimmed cloak trailing behind his body on the ground, heavy and sodden but warm. His father had no more use for it, and Will was shaking with cold. He unfastened the bronze buckle at the dead man's throat and swung the canvas pack over his shoulder before wrapping the cloak around himself. He blew out the lantern and looked back at the dim shapes of his father, of the witch, of his father again, before turning to go down the mountain. The stormy air was electric with whispers, and in the tearing of the wind Will could hear other sounds, too. Confused echoes of cries and chanting, the clash of metal on metal, pounding wing beats that one moment sounded so close they might actually be inside his head, and the next so far away they might have been on another planet. The rocks underfoot were slippery and loose, and it was much harder going down than it had been climbing up, but he didn't falter. And as he turned down the last little gully before the place where he'd left Lyra sleeping, he stopped suddenly. He could see two figures simply standing there in the dark, waiting. Will put his hand on the knife. Then one of the figures spoke.
You're the boy with the knife,
he said, and his voice had the strange quality of those wing beats. Whoever he wasn't a human being.
Who are you? Are you men or...
Not men, no. We are watchers. Bene Elim. In your language, angels.
Will was silent. The speaker went on.
Other angels have other functions and other powers. Our task is simple. We need you. We have been following the shaman every inch of his way, hoping he would lead us to you, and so he has. And now we have come to guide you in turn to Lord Asriel.
You were with my father all the time.
Every moment.
Did he know?
He had no idea.
Why didn't you stop the witch then? Why did you let her kill him?
We would have done, earlier. But his task was over once he'd led us to you.
Will said nothing. His head was ringing. This was no less difficult to understand than anything else.
All right,
he said finally.
I'll come with you. But first I must wake Lyra.
They stood aside to let him pass, and he felt a tingle in the air as he went close to them. But he ignored it and concentrated on getting down the slope toward the little shelter where Lyra was sleeping. But something made him stop. In the dimness, he could see the witches who had been guarding Lyra, all sitting or standing still. They looked like statues, except that they were breathing, but they were scarcely alive. There were several black silk-clad bodies on the ground, too, and as he gazed in horror from one to another of them, Will saw what must have happened. They had been attacked in mid-air by the spectres, and had fallen to their deaths, indifferently. But...
Where's Lyra?
The hollow under the rock was empty. Lyra was gone. There was something under the overhang where she'd been lying. It was Lyra's little canvas rucksack, and from the weight of it he knew without looking that the alethiometer was still inside it. Will was shaking his head. It couldn't be true, but it was. Lyra was gone. Lyra was captured. Lyra was lost. The two dark figures of the Bene Elim had not moved. But they spoke.
You must come with us now. Lord Asriel needs you at once. The enemy's power is growing every minute. The shaman has told you what your task is. Follow us and help us win. Come with us. Come this way. Come now.
And Will looked from them to Lyra's rucksack and back again. And he didn't hear a word they said.
That is the end of The Subtle Knife, written and narrated by Philip Pullman. The Subtle Knife is the second part of a trilogy called His Dark Materials. The first part was called The Golden Compass. The third part is called The Amber Spyglass. Featured in the cast were Joanna Wyatt as Lyra, Stephen Webb as Will, Julian Glover as Stanislaus Grumman, Susan Sheridan as Serafina Pecola, Stephen Thorne as Sir Charles Latram and Thorold, Alison Dowling as Mrs. Coulter, Paul Panting as Pantalaimon, Eve Karpf as Ruta Scardi, and Douglas Blackwell as Giacomo Paradisi. Garrick Hagen was Lee Scoresby, Tim Bentinck was Joachim Lorenz, and Kate Locke was Dr. Mary Malone. Hayward Morse played Fra Pavel and Oliver Payne, and Teresa Gallagher played Lena Felt and Jutta Kamainen. Gordon Reed was the archaeologist and Inspector Walters, and Stephen Greif was Martin Lancelius. Hester and Mrs. Parry were performed by Liza Ross, and Mrs. Cooper and the Tortured Witch by Anne Rosenfeld. Andrew Branch was Kaiser and Alan Perkins. William Roberts played Sam Cancino and Umak, and Nigel Carrington was the voice of the Angel. Emma D'Inverno played Angelica, Arthur Mitchell was Paolo, and the rest of the children were played by Thomas Grundy, Anna Colin, Andrew Lamont, and Fiona Lamont. Other parts were played by members of the cast. The executive producers of this recording were Bruce Colville, Timothy P. Ditlow, and Orly Moskowitz. It was recorded at the BBC Broadcasting House in London, England, where the engineer was Tim Sturgeon. Wolfgang Dienst was the post-production editor, and the music was composed by Peter Ponson. This has been a Story Circle production, directed by Garrick Hagen for Words Take Wing and Listening Library, an imprint of the Random House Audio Publishing Group. Copyright 2000, Random House Incorporated.